I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and welcome to the How Not to Think podcast, the podcast that gets you thinking about your thinking and includes such things as binary thinking, stereotypes, et cetera, et cetera. If you're interested, you can look at my book, I Think, Therefore I'm Wrong, which is available at Amazon. And today, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome from the UK, good old UK, David Robson. David is a man after my own heart in that he's very interested and excellent at writing about cognitive neuroscience. He started with a degree in mathematics from Cambridge University, so you know he's pretty smart, and has worked at The New Scientist, as well as working for BBC Future, where he writes amazing articles. I really appreciate his writing, and it's informed my thinking quite a lot. He did a first book a couple of years ago called The Intelligence Trap, and his new book is already out in the UK and is coming out very shortly, or if not, it is already out in the US, The Expectation Effect, How Your Mind Can Transform Your Life. David, thank you so much for being on the show. It's great to have you.
Yes, completely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's awesome. And for the listeners, I follow David on his BBC work life, typically is where your pieces are published, right? As part of BBC News, which you can look at. And for anyone in the US, an alternative source of news is always welcome. So the BBC is a great site to look at, and David has some great, great posts. He's won awards. He's a great writer. David, how did you get to be where you are today? I mean, you started off with maths at Cambridge, right?
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I mean, I'd always loved writing, you know, at school before I went to university. And actually, it was quite difficult for me while doing my degree in maths, as much as I liked it, to kind of have given up that part of me. So when I left university, it just felt really obvious to me that kind of science communication would be a good way to combine those two kind of skills and passions. I worked for like a kind of B2B, business to business magazine first, and then quickly moved to New Scientist, where I was a features editor, and then the BBC. And you know, along the way, I really cultivated this interest in kind of neuroscience and psychology, you know, something I'd always found fascinating. I'd always read a lot of you know, magazine articles, books about popular psychology, and then it was just fascinating to kind of dive into this scientific literature and to try to communicate that to kind of the public. That was all you know, I'm so grateful for that career. Then, like you mentioned, I kind of left the BBC to write the book The Intelligence Trap, which was all about kind of the reasons that smart people make stupid mistakes. And it was actually kind of while researching that book that I then started to think more carefully about how our assumptions could not only kind of lead us astray kind of intellectually, but actually could create these expectation effects, these kind of self-fulfilling prophecies that can change our perception, behavior, and physiology. And, you know, looking into that literature, I just found that the expectation effect kind of goes way beyond what we might already know about the placebo effect, but actually stretches to all areas of life. So things like how we respond to exercise, to a new diet, even how we age. Like you can even see the products of our expectations and beliefs over a long kind of cumulative process, that the kind of physiological effects can then be found in how quickly our cells biologically age, which sounds impossible, but actually, you know, the scientists have really connected all the dots here. It's all completely evidence-based. And that's basically kind of how I got to be here.
Yeah, and it's great. And I'm so glad you found your sort of purpose and your journey with your writing, because your writing is excellent. It really dives into the topics. It quotes the research very, you know, it's just excellent reporting without opinion, without trying to spin it one way or the other, and is very compelling, which is why I really always look to see whether you got a piece up on the BBC News website. It's really good. And that's interesting how we come to this sort of cognitive neuroscience from quite different perspectives. I mean, you just told yours, your math, interest in science and writing. Your mind was actually being a psychologist and getting into neuroscience and doing, you know, neurofeedback and brain mapping and all of that at the practical end. And so that's fascinating. But I think we arrive at this point where probably, knowing the literature that we do, we have very similar views about the things that you write about and I write about, which is how some of these things that influence our behavior have been completely underestimated, if not ignored, previously, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And well, so I think there's kind of two camps on the expectation effect, actually, and both have been wrong. So there are people who've just kind of dismissed this idea. That was before the recent research that kind of shows that actually they are kind of real phenomena. So that's one, you know, some people are very skeptical. I think other people have been kind of just misguided. And so you have a huge amount of positive thinking literature that's that I don't think is really grounded in science. And so that's kind of claiming that your beliefs and outlook can kind of perform miracles, can perform the impossible. So, you know, this idea that you can visualize yourself being very rich and kind of money comes pouring in, or that you can visualize a tumor disappearing and somehow that will cure you without the assistance of real medical technology. Now, you know, I don't sit in either camp. And I think what actually I really wanted to do with the expectation effect was to show kind of what works and what doesn't, and to kind of define the boundaries of this. And I think what does work is often remarkable, but I'm very much trying to make sure that I don't overemphasize or hype up the power of this, because actually, you know, we need our expectations of the expectation effect to be realistic. There's not going to be any good for anyone in kind of thinking that, you know, just being vaguely optimistic is going to help their life. I actually think that, you know, putting too much pressure on ourselves to kind of to feel optimistic all the time, you know, can actually be quite detrimental to our well-being. And so with the expectation effect, I'm just trying to give people practical techniques to kind of reframe their expectations in ways that have been proven to help them in all of these areas of their lives.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's one of the issues, isn't it, with the positive psychology movement. Part of it is the symbolism of the word positive. I much prefer adaptive, because I think that's what life is about. It's about adapting to things that come up. And that, you know, as soon as you label, oh, this is something terrible, or this is something great, you are limiting your perception of it and all the possibilities that flow from it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I actually think that's the kind of idea that often it's about adaptability is really central to the expectation effect. And it's like you say, it's kind of avoiding falling either side. You don't want to be irrationally positive or negative. You just want to try to be more objective. And, you know, I think one of my favorite examples of that is with this research on reframing anxiety. So before a job interview or an exam, I think lots of us fall into the trap of being too negative, irrationally negative. And we actually just assume that the anxiety itself is a sign that, you know, we're going to fail. Even if we've done all this amazing preparation, we still feel that somehow that the anxiety itself is going to be detrimental to our performance. Now that's a negative expectation effect. And what scientists have found is that actually you can try to teach people about how anxiety itself is neither positive or negative, but it's adaptive. And that it actually, you know, we evolved a lot of these symptoms that we feel, like the racing heartbeat, because that actually should help you to kind of pump blood around your body, you know, get oxygenated blood and fuel into your brain so you can think more sharply. And that, you know, hormones like cortisol can, at moderate levels, can actually be very helpful for sharpening your thinking. Basically what they want is for people to recognize that adaptive response and to stop worrying about the worrying, which is the huge distraction, and which is actually what is detrimental to performance. And that's exactly what they found, that when you get people to just consider that actually their anxiety could be there for a reason and could be helpful, that it is helpful, and that these people actually kind of live up to their potential, whatever that might be, they're more likely to perform as well as they can do, given their kind of knowledge and their skills. And so, yeah, I just think that's key to like all of the expectation effects, that kind of idea that we're not denying our emotions, which is never going to do anyone any good, but we are reframing them and we're reconsidering kind of how we respond to the event and whether actually some of the things that are uncomfortable could actually be potentially, you know, have a purpose for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the basis of my book coming out in April, Falling to Grace, The Art and Science of Redemption, because when people do screw up, there's a real danger they become overly negative. And there's a lot of pressure on that. And certainly in the US, the culture sets all this expectation up. If you really look at the culture here, you know, to be successful, you got to be, you know, a hard ass. You got to be, you know, you got to be almost narcissistic and all of that. And that's simply not true. In fact, the reverse may be true. But that somehow is the mythology in the narrative. And so when people get in difficult situations, the culture is really pressing on them, making it worse, really.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I feel like if you set up these kind of overinflated expectations, then when you're disappointed, then that leads you to kind of rebound to be overly negative. And so that's what, you know, with that's how the expectation effect is different from positive thinking, because it's actually avoiding that overly optimistic viewpoint. And another example I would give is like with kind of people's responses to physical exercise. So there was this amazing study at Stanford University that was published a couple of years ago, where the researchers gave the participants a kind of genetic test that was looking for whether they had a kind of positive variant of the Creb1 gene, so one that actually helps to increase your endurance and, you know, make you feel a bit more comfortable while you're exercising. Like, we know the gene does have this effect. It, you know, these people have lower core body temperature when they're exercising, so they just find it a bit easier. People with the negative variant, you know, find it harder. But the researchers gave the participants sham feedback here. So they, you know, someone who was good at exercise might be told that, you know, actually they're naturally not predisposed to it, and vice versa. And what the researchers found was that those expectations shaped their endurance in a subsequent workout. So what was amazing there was that actually in some of the physiological measures, the objective measures, that the expectations were even more powerful than the actual genes. So in terms of the gas exchange within the lungs, for example, the expectations mattered more than whether you actually had the positive or negative variant. Now, that sounds great. And you might just assume, oh, well, I should just go to the gym and like imagine that I'm Michael Phelps or something. Right. You know, but actually, that's not going to, like, the research is not saying that you can suddenly become an Olympian. But what it is saying is that actually, you might just find it easier than you think if you have the right mindset. And that is something that we should celebrate anyway, because actually most of us aren't working out to become professional athletes. We want to work out to improve our health. And if you're always going to the gym with this kind of negative expectation of what your body can achieve, that's going to be a lot harder. You're going to, you know, it's going to make you miserable doing the workouts and you're less likely to kind of stick to it. And if you can go there with a positive attitude that's improving your mood but also your performance, you're just more likely to stick with it. And I actually think that expectation effect to me is like just as important as if we were telling people that they could all become like Olympians. Like, it's, you know, that's having a real effect on people's lives and their health. And so, you know, it might be less kind of ambitious, less like it's less likely to make headlines, but I think overall, for its potential to do well, to do good for the world, like, that's really important.
Yeah. And again, we get caught up in how these things are presented. And again, with a sort of Superman mindset, there's a good piece again on the BBC that I read yesterday, which was sort of attacking the notion that you could supercharge your immune system. And that actually you couldn't do that. And if you could, it would be a terrible thing, because if you supercharge your immune system, it would overreact and, you know, destroy things it shouldn't, and all of this. And it was an interesting article on this topic, really, about how you take a science idea and then emphasize it beyond its reasonable confines because of media or how you want to present it. Suddenly it's the greatest thing in the world, whereas most of these things are telling us we need balance, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, the immune system tends to be, I think, like very fine-tuned, you know. But we do know that some things like chronic inflammation, you know, kind of throws the immune system out of balance. And so that's bad for, like, if you're receiving the vaccine, it means it's less likely to kind of mount such a good response and remember the kind of immunity for longer. And, you know, like, it does mean that, say, if you are infected with a virus, that actually you might struggle to fight it so much. But yeah, like you say, we don't, that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to kind of beef up the immune system or activate it excessively, but you just want to kind of remove those barriers, like inflammation, excessive inflammation that might actually be preventing it from working as it should. And right. You know, like, maybe some lifestyle factors do help you to do that, but it's just been overhyped, kind of what you can achieve, and then that's only detrimental to people, because if you overhype something that isn't, you know, true, doesn't turn out to be true, it just erodes people's trust in the science.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also illogical, isn't it, when you say, well, a healthy immune system, you know, is good for whatever, but a super healthy one is, no, that isn't, that there's no logic in that, right?
No.
There is no logic. It's a logical error. And and you find this happens all the time with people.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like one of my relatives, he reads these kinds of things, and then, you know, you might be told to eat like a certain number of like fruit and vegetables each day. And so he takes that to the extreme, and he's like, well, if they say, you know, more carrots, then I'm going to eat like 100 carrots, because that must make it like proportionally stronger. And like, that's absolutely not what we should be doing, because, you know, actually, like, there's evidence, I think, with like lots of vitamins and, you know, antioxidants, that actually excessive levels can also be quite harmful for things like the immune system. So, like you say, it's all about balance. I mean, while we're talking about the immune system, you know, I do think expectation effects come into this. And again, it's not like you're just making small changes to immune function, but there is evidence that, say, when a doctor sees a patient with a cold and tells them, they kind of just give them a kind of their, first of all, they're empathetic, so they show that they care. And then they just give them an objective but kind of positive expectation. So they tell you that, you know, this virus is just going to clear up by itself. It's just reassuring to hear that, to know that you're not going to be suffering for a long time. But actually, those words are kind of biologically active. So what you do find is that even with measures of things like inflammation within the nose, that actually it just speeds up the process of getting better. So people who have that reassurance actually get better about a day earlier than people who don't, which, you know, most colds last less than a week. So it's substantial, really. It's like one less day of suffering. It's actually about the same effect as if you take a zinc supplement each day. So, you know, not something to be dismissed, but also it's not going to like cure you instantly. And, you know, I think, again, it's like a small improvement is something that we should be looking for and should be celebrating, because, you know, if you have small improvements in all areas of your life, it can actually just make things a lot easier for you.
Absolutely. And one of the things that sort of a hobby horse of mine is indeed communication from, you know, health professionals and doctors, which I don't believe they're trained in, or certainly weren't in my day. And this is important. And the example that I use is, if, you know, your oncologist tells you, yeah, you've got this, most people, you know, die within 3 years, and you believe it, you're probably going to die within 3 years. However, again, it might be that 90% of people die within 3 years, but there's another 10% who, you know, on average live 12 years, right? And again, this speaks to the power of the expectation effect. You here you are as a professional who knows about this stuff. People are going to believe what you say. It is going to impact them via an expectation effect.
That's right. I mean, I think also like I think like doctors do vary quite widely in kind of how they communicate. And I do know like of lots of doctors that are actually like I've heard from some after the publication of my book who are actually already very on board with this and have kind of welcomed the message. But I think like in terms of prognoses, actually, it is easy to just take like an average for the whole population. But actually, if you're 40 and you're diagnosed with some kind of cancer, like your odds of kind of surviving are going to be very different from someone who's 40 years older again. And, you know, things like your current level of health and even the activities that you perform while you're receiving treatment. So there's some emerging evidence that people who do exercise kind of before chemotherapy and if possible while they're undergoing chemotherapy, they're just more likely to kind of be able to tolerate the chemotherapy, which actually then means that the doctors have a better chance of kind of dealing with the cancer itself. But I do think if you're given this kind of message that, you know, like your chances of survival are just if they're you're being told it's low and that's not necessarily justified by the data, then that could just prevent people from doing things that actually might just increase their chances. So none of this is kind of magical and none of this is, you have to be like super optimistic or to have this hope. And actually it's like a horrible thing to deal with. And like, you know, and it's impossible to kind of maintain a good mood and you don't want to put that pressure on people. I do think that there are just kind of trying to kind of present the information in a way that people can understand and in a way that kind of allows them to come to their own kinds of conclusions is actually can be really powerful in just helping to make the experience as tolerable as it possibly can be.
Yeah, and I have a couple of examples of people who've naturally done that. I have a neighbor who was having some problems to do with her internal organs, went to the doctor. Doctor said, 95% chance, this is nothing, okay? And she said, that's not good enough for me. Is there any more advanced tests I can do? And he said, well, yeah, you could get a proper, you know, big MRI and we can do all these things. She said, sign me up. She was coming out of that procedure and the person who done it said, boy, you're one lucky woman. We just found the beginning of pancreatic cancer.
Wow.
And that was like 12 years ago. Yeah. And by and large, she's been in remission. And that's interesting. You know, that's the sort of mindset that I think people should have. Okay, well, 95%, am I going to take the responsibility of that? Or what happened, you know, where's the other? And I know another woman who was given the diagnosis that she's gene positive for Huntington's disease, which runs in her family and so forth. And she said, well, this diagnosis is not for me. What she wasn't denying the diagnosis because the evidence was there, but she was asking the question, what can I do to give myself the best chance of delaying this from manifesting? And that was 16 years ago, and you know, she's fine. So I think that mindset, not a sort of a woo-woo thing. No. Oh, if I just pray to the universe that I'll be, you know, I don't think that's going to work. But if you have a mindset, an adaptive mindset, that there must be the best things that I can do, you know, what are the best things I can do to give myself the best chance, right?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, we do see this in a much more general way with people's beliefs about aging. So especially with the ageism in society, it's very easy for us to only associate aging with all of the negative things that you hear about. So, you know, cognitive decline, physical decline, disability, heart disease, Alzheimer's, you know. Now, that, you know, we can't deny that actually like age is a risk factor for all of these things. But, you know, some people will only focus on that and they will assume that that's inevitable. And other people take the view that, you know, aging, you know, comes with those problems, but that, you know, like it comes with some benefits too. Like your general knowledge, your vocabulary is never better than when you're kind of in your 70s. Your decision making actually continues to improve throughout life. So you find it easier to kind of look for compromises and to take other perspectives, all of these kinds of things, even to avoid some cognitive biases. So, you know, it's swings and roundabouts, as we would say in the UK. And what we find is that actually then those mindsets actually do have an effect on how well people age. There's a one study that found that actually people with the wholly negative views are about they die about 7.5 years earlier than the people with the positive views. And that's, you know, that's a shocking result. And then the scientists have kind of looked at how that might be. And the really obvious case is that people with the negative views just kind of give up on doing exercise or eating well because they have a kind of fatalistic outlook. And that probably is true. But what we can also see is that actually there's this kind of physiological response that seems to be linked to our stress responses. So if you associate old age with vulnerability, every challenge around you starts to look a bit more difficult. So you it's all more stressful and not a good kind of stress. It's like you're kind of responding as if you're threatened, as if you're in danger. That elevates levels of cortisol to a level that's beyond what would be healthy. And then that leads to things like bodily inflammation, which can lead to wear and tear on tissues. And then we see that actually those effects can be seen in the cells in the kind of epigenetic markers. So the molecular clock within your cells is ticking a little bit quicker. You know, that seems to have this effect on longevity. But what I find especially interesting is that actually it seems to interact with our genetic profile. So the one example that has been tested is looking at people with high-risk genes for Alzheimer's disease. What you find there is that even amongst the group with the high-risk genes, that actually these age beliefs can have quite profound effects. And if you have the high-risk gene, but you also have a positive view, your risk does kind of drop to the kind of average level across the population. So it's actually counteracting some of the danger that comes with your genes. I think that's just so profound, but I actually think then that's really something that we should consider when thinking about genetic counseling, because you could easily see that if you're told you have the high risk gene, that is going to promote the negative view of aging, and then the two together are going to interact to actually put you at an increased risk. So,
Yeah,
you know, it's a complicated
absolutely.
issue for how you communicate that risk without causing that kind of vicious cycle. But I think it's something we need to consider really carefully as kind of genetic tests become more and more common.
Yes, and I've done some work with Dean and Ayesha Shirzai, you know, their book, The Alzheimer's Solution, where they say that really it's those lifestyle practices, those healthy lifestyle practices that are really key in that. You know, the genetics can be altered. And again, if you have, it's not just having that healthier mindset, it's what behaviors then follow as a result of having a healthier mindset. So that would be interesting. Two groups who had a healthy mindset about aging, one group who, you know, exercised, ate healthily, slept well, and the other who really didn't much, you know, how much would it be an expectation effect? How much of that drive behaviors that are important? And I think this is very important in relation to behavior change in general. Spent a lot of my career working on that, been trained really in the behavioral approach, which I see as limited. But and this also speaks to your article today about a connection with the future self. You don't have a connection with the future self. If you don't have the right expectation, going on a diet to lose weight is probably not going to work. Okay? Because if your motivation is all in the future and you really don't have much connection with the future, chances are it's going to be overwhelmed by the gravitational pull of old habits, right? And I think that's what you're going to see. And so without that adaptive mindset, I'm not saying positive, it's not saying, oh, I'm going to be sure, I'm going to do great. Adaptive, how do I do this each day and challenge? It's going to be a problem. And I think this is relates to any sort of change people are trying.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. You know, there is some research that I talk about in my book, which looks at kind of people's willpower mindsets as well. And, you know, like I think, you know, we had this idea of like ego depletion in the brain, which may or may not be true, but it certainly like is affected by expectation as well. So that was just this idea that like self-control is just really difficult, inherently difficult for people, and it's like exhausting this biological resource, which means that you know after a certain amount of time exercising your willpower, you find it, you know, increasingly difficult, and you're going to give in to temptation eventually. It's kind of, you know, taken to the extreme, that can be quite fatalistic. But what the researchers show is that, well, that is true if you're someone with the belief that willpower is limited. But actually, lots of people, especially incidentally in certain cultures like in India, but also, you know, there's variation in any country, that they have this idea that willpower is non-limited, and that actually exercising your willpower can be energizing. And we might have all experienced this at some points with certain tasks, I think, because, you know, we talk about kind of getting in the zone. And that's this idea, you know, actually it can be a little bit difficult to kind of start focusing on something. But then as you kind of focus, it becomes kind of self-perpetuating, you know, you're kind of caught in that kind of moment, and that you're kind of feeling stronger and stronger. It's like you're kind of practicing, and that's actually strengthening your resolve. Now, people who have that mindset in general, you know, about all kinds of tasks, do just seem to find it much easier to maintain their willpower and to stick to their goals. So to stick to a fitness regime, to stick to a diet, to kind of stick to their studies, even to do things like, you know, go to sleep at a reasonable time, take the medication, you know, all of these things. But if we only read the literature on ego depletion and assume that that is true for everyone, and that you can't do anything to change that, then, you know, you're going to find it harder to kind of stick to your goals. That's becoming the self-fulfilling prophecy. So, yeah, I totally agree with you that actually our mindsets are really important, you know, not just in controlling our physiology, but definitely in controlling our behavior and in making it likely whether we can actually kind of stick to our behaviors to reach those goals. And what the literature shows is that actually we can change our willpower mindsets quite effectively, and that then that can, you know, help us in this process.
You might be interested in one of my PhD projects, which don't think you could do it today. I started my career in the addictions field. Was taking impatient alcoholics and putting alcohol in front of them, but asking them, you can drink it if you want, but the idea is you resist it for 20 minutes, right? And see whether, you know, that got easier simply by practicing it in that situation. And then there was, interestingly enough, another group who did that, but they also had some sessions of visualization where they were actually visualizing themselves doing that as well. And the results had some, you know, it's a small study, so they had some impact, but the visualization actually really helped, it seemed, that actually seeing yourself doing it as well as doing it was helpful in giving you, I guess, the expectation that I can beat this, you know, I don't have to pick it up and drink it.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. And I do think that fits with the research, not with people who have addictions, but just kind of the general population, that with all of these expectation effects, and especially with something like willpower, that I think is actually we want to kind of build up slowly, you know, and push ourselves out of our comfort zone and just kind of test our assumptions. So that's definitely what I would advocate for, like building willpower, is that you know, there might be, you know, some task that you really normally like struggle to concentrate on without procrastinating, without being distracted, or there might be something like, you know, resisting the biscuit tin, you know, and maybe like if you really struggle to keep yourself control in the past, like you have to take kind of baby steps. But actually, like the more you kind of succeed, the more you've proved yourself that, you know, you are capable of this, that's boosting your expectation. It's helping you to move to that non-limited willpower mindset, and then, you know, over time, if you focus on that trajectory, you're much more likely to reach your goal. If you just kind of immediately try to like make a huge change to your life and you're over ambitious and then you fail, I think that's actually then going to reinforce the idea that you know you're just not cut out for it. You naturally have low self-control, and that's, you know, going to lead to things like the what the hell effect, you know, when people go on a diet and they might be doing great for like a month and then they eat one piece of cake and then they just give up the whole thing because they assume that there's no point anymore. You know, we want to avoid that because actually, you know, small failures are just a sign that what you're trying to achieve is difficult. Yeah, exactly. But if you just focus, if you just accept that, then maybe like you failed once, but it's not something, it's not a sign of something innate within you, and that you can kind of get back on the wagon very quickly. That's a much healthier way of approaching it.
Definitely, definitely. And again, it speaks to the sort of cultural messaging we have about all of these things. We were talking about aging there. And of course, it's very common for most people as they age, you know, to go into the closet and can't remember why they went in there. You know, short-term memory is easily interrupted and what have you. And then they interpret that as, oh my God, I'm getting Alzheimer's. Yeah. And when I speak to somebody like that, you know, and they say, yeah, I keep, you know, and do this and I can't. I said, do you have something on your computer that cleans the drive, you know, that you put on and takes out files it hasn't used for a long time? And she said, yeah. I said, well, that's the same process. You don't need those files. So it's just, you know, why cram up your brain? You're using too much space. So you don't need to remember these things. So, you know, it's okay. It's not a sign that you've got Alzheimer's or you're going into cognitive decline. And again, if you present it like that, I think it's much more helpful. You know, now, clearly for some people, it could be a sign of future things, but in itself is not, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't have to take it as, I think it's avoiding that question, that kind of assumption that it's kind of inevitable, you know, keeping an open mind. And, you know, there's lots of research, I think, along similar lines showing that actually, as people get older, because they have this assumption that their memory is going to fail, they actually stop using their memory and they start using kind of physical crutches. So, you know, the simple example is if you're kind of driving to a new location, they would be more likely to use GPS rather than kind of working out for themselves. And, you know, they would keep on using GPS when previously they might have just relied on their memory and accepted that, you know, their memory might fail, but then they can kind of look at a map and then kind of go back to using their memory. And, you know, with memory, it is often like use it or lose it. But if you, because of your assumptions, just stop using it, then you're going to accelerate the decline.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in your, and I think your book, The Expectation Effect, the subtitle is about how to, what's the subtitle again? I've forgotten.
It's how your mindset can transform.
That's right. Your life. Yeah. And the, where I was going with that was all aspects of your life, right? All aspects of your life. You know, we're not just talking about health or dementia or anything like that.
No, exactly. That's what I think. It's like, you know, it's changing your perception kind of day to day. Like, that's very well established in the psychological literature. There's this idea now that the, from kind of studies of consciousness, that the brain is a prediction machine. So that had primarily focused on perception. And the idea here is that actually the data hitting your senses is pretty rough, actually. Like, it's not pretty. I mean, like, you know, the our retinas are kind of 2D, you know, a lot of the data that's coming in is often quite ambiguous, you know, different lighting, you know, with the perspective, with distance, it's often, it's, it wouldn't be obvious to know kind of how big objects are, kind of when they're overlapping, when they're separate objects, when they're joined, all of these things. But your brain is then using its expectations to, and experiences, it's kind of learned from experience, kind of how to interpret this. To make sense of it into something that's understandable. And according to this idea of the brain as a prediction machine, it's almost like building a whole simulation of the world around you. And then the data from the eyes is kind of, or the ears, or, you know, touch is updating those simulations. It's tweaking the simulations. But what you actually experience is the simulation. And that's quite profound because, you know, often the simulation coincides with reality, you know, almost perfectly, or good enough that we experience, you know, we don't notice if it's got any errors. The errors are so small, but sometimes the errors can be quite problematic. You know, people can see hallucinations, not just if they have a mental illness, but even, you know, certain ambiguous scenarios where the data is just not very good at updating the simulations. So in the book, I give this example of when Gatwick Airport, which is one of the most one of the UK's biggest airports, had to close for 2 days before Christmas because there were loads of people reporting seeing drones above the airport that might be dangerous to the planes. You know, all started from just one report. We don't know what that person saw, but what seems to have happened is that then they created this expectation amongst lots of other people that there was this kind of drone attack. And then lots of other people, because of that expectation, their prediction machine was kind of encouraging them to see drones in the grey winter sky. And when you know, things like the army's radar could detect nothing, and there are no photos of these drones, despite there being 70 sightings or more, 70 sightings, I think, just from what the police considered to be very reliable witnesses. So, you know, yeah, like I think every minute of every day, our perception and our behavior and our physiology is being shaped by our expectations. Like expectation effects are just part of our life. We might not know that they're happening, but right. Once we do understand those processes, we can try to optimize our expectations just to make sure that we're not suffering from needlessly negative expectation effects, and that we can actually try to make sure that we can bring about more positive change to our lives.
Yeah, really well stated, really well stated, and absolutely right that we have to recognize that what comes into our consciousness is a function of many variables, not the true reality that is out there, whatever that is, right? That's really interesting. It's almost like you're going back to sort of Buddhist psychology of the fact that, you know, our consciousness creates our reality through these various mechanisms, and that's true, it does. The problem is that most people don't understand that. They don't realize that. They don't realize the power of that. You know, they might say, oh, well, yeah, I could see I might have been influenced a little bit by this, but they don't understand how that is the modus operandi of consciousness, how it's working all the time.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you mentioned kind of Buddhist thinking, which I think is very relevant. I also see it as being like kind of Plato's idea of the seeing the shadows on the wall of the cave, you know, in a way, like our mental simulations are like those shadows. We're not seeing the actual thing in front of us, we're seeing something that's one removed from them. You know, like you say, like I think, like we do need to realize this, because often I think our expectations are shaping our perception in ways that are then affecting things like our mood, and vice versa, for a kind of feedback loop. So now I think we can all kind of identify those times when we wake up maybe in a bad mood, and then, you know, you might be on the train and you look around you and you just get the sense that people are being a bit hostile to you. Like, you know, that they might be frowning at you. They might, you know, someone might have nudged you, you think, in a way that was quite rude. Like you might think you've overheard someone saying an insult. But the fact is that could and probably is partly a kind of product of the expectations that came from the mood, and then it's like reinforcing the bad mood. And I think it can be quite profound to just kind of understand that and to just question, like, maybe, like, I'm not seeing the world the way it really is today. And maybe, like, I don't have to, like, you know, let these perceptions, let these expectations kind of become self-fulfilling and confirming, and just kind of take a step back. Like, I just try to, if I feel that's happening to me, to just kind of look around and just try to notice who's, you know, smiling around me, and who's actually being friendly. And that just kind of, for me at least, helps to break the cycle a little bit.
Yeah, I think we start though with the awareness, which is why I think your expectation effect book is going to be so powerful and valuable for people, because you have to be aware that's what's happening. And we don't. And, you know, I think that one of the areas, and I've talked about this in my book too, is that, you know, let's suppose you're in a situation, you're in the forest and you hear something seems to be moving in the trees and there's a strange sound. Oh, those two things must be connected, right? Well, actually what your brain is saying, test that out. Maybe those two things are connected and you need to know that. But what happens, people are missing out. Let's test this out. We're going into false association of things, right? They're not digging deeper. You know, your brain is saying, well, this is my best guess, but you better test it out. But now it's two things that seem to be they obviously cause each other, right? And that's dangerous. You know, it leads to conspiracy theories. It leads to all sorts of distortion. The brain is saying to us, could be, you might want to check it out and test this out. Oh my God, those two things are obviously connected. I got to do, you know.
Yeah, and I think just at the very basic level of like where your attention falls is often, that's the most basic way the brain can kind of test out its simulations and try to get better data to update the simulations if it thinks there's an error in what it's predicting. But yeah, like you say, I think then at a cognitive level, you know, what happens is that it also leads people into this kind of idea of, you know, they see causation when there isn't any. And that kind of pattern is that kind of pattern recognition, pattern matching kind of process then leads to us to kind of make false assumptions about the world. And actually having that mindset that we just need to check before we come to a conclusion is so important.
Yeah, instead of confirmation bias, we're just looking for the things that support our idea and ignore anything that might discredit it, right? And that's where people go. They don't go down to, let me check this out further. It's, oh, no, I'm right. Let me find all the evidence that proves I'm right and trash anything that says I'm not right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, then that goes back to things like how we deal with stress as well. Because, you know, like if we kind of see a situation as just being inherently stressful and the stress is being inherently bad for us, then actually we often, you know, well, the body starts to prepare as if it's in danger with a kind of over exaggerated stress response that can be harmful for our health in the long term. But also it changes the way we cope because we just it's natural to try to avoid those situations, but often the situations aren't going to go away if you don't look at them. And so that's why if you change your stress mindset, so if you start to see that stress can be adaptive and that, you know, there's a reason for doing that and that actually you might need to approach the thing that's causing you stress to find out more about it and then to look for a more proactive ways of coping, that actually, you know, it might be uncomfortable, but that is going to then help you to reduce the stressful situation in the long run.
Right.
And so I think that's why stress mindsets can themselves be so powerful for our overall long-term health and like our risk of burnout and even things like our risk of cardiovascular disease, because I think it's happening on multiple levels. It's changing our perception, you know, kind of what you're focusing on in the situation, how your attention is being is kind of moving about the situation. It's changing our behaviors, which may then actually change the level of stress within the situation. And on top of that is changing your physiological response. So it's just helping you to recover from the stress better. I think like actually it plays out in so many different ways. And, you know, it all comes back, like you say, from this survival perspective, you know, that if you're like expecting to see a predator, if you're on a hunt, there are two different types of stressful situations that need separate kinds of responses. But actually in modern life, I think we just get them confused. And thanks to our expectation effects, and we often always respond to challenges as if they're a threat rather than seeing them as a kind of potential opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. This is awesome. David, thank you so much. We're going to have you back on the show because we could talk about this indefinitely. And it's great talking to you. As usual, you are you actually know the data, you present it in a reasonable and fair way and easily point out the challenges that we as humans have in taking what are just best guesses from our mind body and, you know, knowing how to understand. And I really think that being aware just of that is the first step and very, very important. So the expectation effect coming out February 15th, I believe, right, in the US.
Right.
If people want to reach out to you generally, where can they find you? I will put this in the show notes, but just for those who are listening.
So my website is www.davidrobson.me, and that's got a kind of contact form. So I do read all of the messages. I often can't respond to all of them, but you know, it really matters to me actually to hear what people think. So that's one way. I'm also on Twitter, D_A_Robson, and LinkedIn. You can just search for me if you search for like David Robson author. So you know, I'd love it if people do reach out. And yeah, just to say also that it's always appreciated by authors if you do read the book to then leave a review on kind of Goodreads, Amazon, on, you know, any kind of local bookshop website is always wonderful for us too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you and good luck with the book. Let's hope it does really well. And I'll keep writing those BBC articles, because without them, I don't know where my books would be. Well, sort of.
No, thanks so much for your interest and encouragement. It really means a lot.
You're welcome.